You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
You're listening to Muses and Stuff. This is the podcast that's all about the dolls. They were the groupies, the wives, the girlfriends, and the muses who played such a huge role in rock and roll history by simply being themselves.
They were sweet, sexy, brave, and powerful. They went after what and who they wanted, and they made no apologies.
We are your hosts, Shanti and Lynx.
Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Muses and Stuff. I'm sitting here with Lynx.
Hello. It's so nice to be back after last week.
Yeah, you weren't here last week, and I talked about the Backstreet Boys, and I just told everybody that you were pulling a Courtney Love, and you were off in Alaska, just like figuring some shit out.
I needed that time.
How's Alaska?
Wonderful.
Good. But really, what have you been up to?
I've seen a couple great shows recently. I got to see Ryan Adams, and he's always just fantastic. And he was at Massey Hall, and the sound there is just incredible. So that was wonderful. And also got to see Jesus and Mary Chain. Never thought I'd ever get to see them live, so that was unbelievable. They were also fantastic. Sadly, they said that this is their last tour, though. So,
and you were there.
Yeah. Though I think they said that like 10 years ago. Mm. So you never know. They're one of those bands that love and hate each other, I think. So
nice.
Yeah. But yeah, it was wonderful. And you got to see
Mac DeMarco.
Yes.
Yeah, I saw Mac DeMarco a couple of weekends ago, which was amazing. He was the Danforth.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go, but it was the same night as Jesus and Mary Chain.
Yeah. No, the energy was amazing. Everybody in the room was just having a great time. And I was there with, my family and people who I really care about. So mm-hmm. It was the best. And this weekend, I went to a show at the Horseshoe, Wind Hand. And I didn't know who they were, but my cousins were in from out of town, and they really liked them. Mm-hmm. And so my cousin's husband said to me, "Oh, do you think that we could meet the band?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course. Sure, no problem."
The Horseshoe's great for that.
It really is. Yeah. And sometimes it's just a matter of, like, you see the person and mm-hmm. you just do it. So I was with him and his friend outside, and they were smoking a cigarette, and I was just out there for some air. I hadn't gone outside for the whole night, but on that particular like time to go outside, I went, I'm gonna join you guys. So I went outside. We were standing out front, and the main badass woman from Windhand was outside, just also like, you know, getting some air. So my cousin was like, "That's her," and I was like, "Oh, cool!" Like, now would be a great time to go tell her that you're a fan and that you came from Sudbury to see her. And he was just like, "No, I can't do it." And so I was like, "Don't worry about it. I got it." So there was like some street artist doing something. So she was kind of watching. So I just asked her what she thought about it. And then as I was walking back to the guys, she just kind of followed. And we all just engaged in a really nice conversation. And then my cousin asked for a picture. And it was really nice. And so it's nice to... It's happened a couple of times now where, like, family has asked me, like, do you think that we could meet this person? And I've been like, let me see what I can do.
I got this.
And then I've delivered both times. So it's nice to...
That's great. And speaking of the horseshoe, I was actually there recently as well for CJ Ramon. And I got to hang out with my good friend Randy, who's a fellow groupie sister.
Hey, Randy.
She actually knew one of the guys in the band. So, yeah, we hung out with them, and it was just so awesome to see Randy. We had so many crazy teenage adventures and seeing bands and meeting bands and getting up to no good.
But they're great stories now, so... Yes.
So, yeah, shout out to you, Randy. I love you, and I'll see you again soon.
Wonderful. Yeah. So I have a couple of things to tell you, and I said I'll just wait until recording, and then I'll tell you. One of those things is that this weekend, so this May long weekend, mm-hmm. is the 1 year anniversary of the idea of this podcast.
Ooh.
Yeah. So.
And look how far it's come.
I know.
That's so exciting.
So it was this weekend last year that I was sitting outside with TJ and we were listening to another podcast, and I had just written out a whole bunch of stuff wondering what I should do with it. And then it was just the moment of inspired thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's what my friend Lindsay B calls an inspired thought. And when you have one, you have to pay attention to them, because if I hadn't.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So that's when I started writing things down, going, this is what it's going to turn into. And then it was, okay, in June, I'm going to start getting everything together so that
it can make this happen. And let this be a lesson to anyone out there listening to this. If you have some idea that you're sitting on, go out and do it. Like, look at how far this has come in a year. It's so exciting. All it takes is you putting in the work, and it's certainly worth it.
Yeah, and believing in yourself that you can do it. And yeah. then if you have, you know, people who... And it just starts with you too, right?
Yeah, and just one step at a time.
And then other people will jump on your inspired thought too.
Yes.
So speaking of coming, you know, away in a year,
mm-hmm.
we have the TO Webfest coming up.
Yes.
So that's going to be this weekend. So this episode comes out on Wednesday. That means tomorrow, Thursday, we're going to be at the CN Tower kicking things off, meeting everybody.
It's exciting that it's at the CN Tower, too. It feels
yeah.
all the more special.
Yeah. So last year, this time was an idea. This year is a nomination in the category of achievement for a podcast. And we are nominated alongside a couple of really amazing podcasts called Ross Never Sleeps, Speech Bubble Podcast, and Chico Chico.
Cool.
Yeah. So what's been really nice about this is the amount of support from all of the other creators, that it's not this kind of like...
it doesn't feel like
us
competition.
Versus them competition. Yeah. It's everybody's just really excited to be a part of it.
And it's a community.
Supporting one another.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of really nice support and sharing things back and forth on Instagram and Twitter. And then the other thing I wanted to tell you was that the Speech Bubble Podcast wrote us a really nice review on iTunes.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll read it to you right now.
Please.
As the host of my own podcast, nice shout out. Or nice, what's it called when you promote yourself?
Self-promotion.
Self-promotion. Yeah, I think it's great. You got to, right?
Absolutely.
So, their name was From Speech Bubble to Muses. As the host of my own podcast, I know how much work production can be and how much time it takes. These girls don't skip on the research, and their interviews go way deeper than the superficial junket stuff. I also love the strength and femme positivity that comes through in every episode. Women rock more than ever.
Ah, that's fabulous. That's exactly the kind of feedback that we hope to get. So that's wonderful. I'm excited to check out their podcast.
Yeah, totally.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, yeah, WebFest is coming up, and I think that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, well, we'll give you all the info after.
Yeah, and we'll so we've got to get into our person this week.
This one's an exciting one.
Oh my God! So Miss Odell, Chris Odell. Yes. I read Chris Odell's autobiography given to me by Lynx, and the title of this book is Miss Odell: My Hard Days and Long Nights with the Beatles, the Stones, Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, and the Women They Loved.
That sums it up exactly. Perfect.
Ooh, it's so good. This has been one of my favorite reads. Mm-hmm. So out of all of the groupie books that we've read so far, and we've read a lot so far, I'd have to say, like, if I had to do a top five, I'd say Pamela DeBar. Of course, I'm with the band Confessions of a Groupie.
Absolutely.
I really liked Patty Boyd's Wonderful Tonight, Catherine James. Dandelion, and Miss Odell. That's four. I can't even think of a five. I did like Baby Buell a lot.
It's hard to pick. It's really hard to pick. It really depends on... I go through phases where I'm like obsessively listening to the Beatles and the Stones. And so, of course, Chris's book would be amazing for that. And then sometimes I'm like really into my punk rock and I'll read, you know, the Please Kill Me by Legs McNeil and those books. And... it really, I obsessively love certain things until I can't stand them anymore for a while.
Oh my God. Okay, I have to tell you this story. So I was speaking to a 12-year-old the other day and I had this song stuck in my head. So I put the song on and I said, do you ever wake up in the morning and you have a song stuck in your head and the only way to make it better is just by listening to it? Mm-hmm. And he was like, no, not really. He was like... but when I really like a song, I listen to it over and over and over again until it makes me physically sick. So I don't have a favorite song.
Oh my God, that's me.
So that's you. I just laughed. Okay.
Oh my God. No, that's definitely me. I do that with like everything in life too, like food, movies. I'll just find something that I really love for a while and then I'll squeeze all the life out of it and then I'll move on. But it's not that I hate that, and it certainly doesn't make me sick. It's just that my focus shifts for a while, but it always comes back
for sure.
Yeah. But I definitely I never knew I had a child out there.
Yeah, apparently. So the thing is with Chris Odell's book too, every third page had a sticky note in it. And I don't know how you do your research, but every time I stop at something that I find really interesting, I just put a ripped up piece of paper in it. But I took out most of the stickies.
Oh my God.
Because I didn't need them. So I just kept, every time I said, like, go read this part of the book.
Yeah.
Because she had such a crazy awesome life. She's had a bunch of songs written by her, for her. George Harrison, Joni Mitchell, Leon Russell, but like, we will get to those.
Yes.
So thank you for giving me this book.
I had this feeling that you were going to respond to it.
Oh my God. It's the most intimate, like, account of the Beatles.
Yes.
That I've ever read.
And it's really great, too, because she wasn't a wife.
Right.
So she does have a perspective that some of the women don't have because they were like emotionally deep into it, you know?
But she was a best friend, and she was a best friend to Patty Boyd and Maureen.
Yes.
We'll get to. So Chris Odell was born and grew up in Kyoto, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Okay. So she called herself an eager helper. She wanted to be liked and accepted and just to be a friend. She wanted to make people happy. Her sister had chronic pneumonia and her father was a teacher, and so she was alone a lot. She internalized that she was to take care of myself and do the best that I could, and no matter what the circumstances, keep a big smile on my face. So she always considered herself and told herself that she wasn't the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. And that later came in handy with her when she was interacting with all these people like the Rolling Stones.
Who felt like they were the center of the universe.
Who really believed that they were the center of the universe, that she was always honest with them, saying like, I never pretended that they weren't famous, or never pretended like I didn't know that they were famous. Mm-hmm. And but I just let them shine. Yeah. And I was there to be there for them.
The perfect support system.
Yeah. She really was a big support system. So when she was 20 years old, she was living in Hollywood. She had moved there about 2 years before that. And it was when she was in LA at the age of 20 that she had had an introduction that would set off the course of her life.
Just a chance encounter.
And changed it. Do you remember what that chance encounter was?
I do.
All right. Do you want to tell them?
No, you go.
Oh, okay.
You got the notes. Oh. You got the many, many, many notes.
I've got the 14 pages of notes in front of me, so settle in, people. We're going for a ride. Okay.
And so it starts.
Okay, so she was just one night staying in. She was going to smoke a joint, relaxing when she gets a phone call. And she gets a phone call from her friend Alan, who wanted to introduce her to somebody named Derek Taylor. This was in 1968. Mm-hmm. So she said, oh, I don't really want to come out. And he said, you have to. And then she just had this feeling like, I need to go out and my life will change. And it was absolutely true. So Derek Taylor had just started working for Apple. Yep. And so that's where the Beatles were. The Beatles had built it. And they had completely hit it off, her and Derek, and they spent the night in Laurel Canyon laughing, smoking joints, whatever. And he said to her, Apple is going to be huge. It would be a very good time for you to appear, you know.
I love how back then, like, you could just appear in these people's lives.
Yeah. So she didn't go right away. She didn't go, yeah, right away. Because she was like, well, seriously, what am I supposed to do? Just pick up and leave and
yeah,
just
go show all the way up to at Apple England Music?
And it turns out, like, yes, it's exactly what she was supposed to do, and she eventually did. So he called her every few months to check in. And there's a really great... just really great description of what Apple headquarters was at the time in its early days at 3 Savile Road, and like what their mission was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So she got to know Peter Asher, yep. And she started working.
Jane Asher's brother.
Yeah. So he was around a lot.
Beatles wrote a song for him.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Hmm. So she was saying about how the first time, one of the first Beatles that she ever saw in, like, when she finally eventually got there was Paul McCartney, and just, like, how much her heart was thumping. I think it was she was working for Neil Aspinall when she got there. She was his kind of assistant, and Neil was, like, considered the fifth Beatle. Quick when she'd gotten there as well, she was all of a sudden in the same room with Peter Asher, Neil Aspinall, Paul McCartney, and John and Yoko. And she doesn't remember a word of the conversation because she couldn't believe that she was there.
Yeah, one day in California, the next day you're sitting in Apple, like, with the biggest rock and roll stars, like, ever.
But at this point, she was just kind of off to the side.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
They didn't know who she was really yet. It was funny because one of the first nights when she was in London, she got set up with somebody, and he was an American. So she wasn't pumped about it, but it was another thing that was like, somebody was like, let him come over to your place. You're really going to like him. He's kind of lonely. He needs a friend. And it ended up being James Taylor. So he ended up staying and working all night on one of his beautiful songs. And, like, he wouldn't leave. She said he wouldn't leave. So she was trying to give him hints.
What a,
like,
problem.
Yeah, putting rollers in her hair. And he's like, do you mind if I just stay and I'll just crash here. Don't worry. And she's like, well, the bed's really small. And she put rollers in her hair so he wouldn't try anything. He's like, oh, don't worry about it. So she woke up in the middle of the night and he was just, like, huddled beside her next to the wall, kind of sleeping. And the next day... The next day she went to his rehearsal and was like, oh, this guy's a genius. Okay.
Yeah.
So she was just working at Apple, just trying to make herself as useful as possible in the early days. So she was working the switchboard at one point. She said every morning Paul would walk in and he'd do his rounds. and that he would pop by to every single room in the building and just make sure he said hello to everybody. And so one day he popped into the switchboard and he told her to stick around. You'll never know what could happen.
Aww.
Yeah. So this is when she started getting into recording sessions and the Beatles really started to notice her because the recording sessions were closed.
Mm-hmm.
Except for, like, sometimes the girlfriends would sit there, like, and watch.
Yeah.
So she ended up getting in with somebody who was working on the session. I forget who it was. He just kind of came in, and she had asked Paul earlier if she could go, and he kind of gave her a weird look and was like, yeah, sure. But then somebody else had said, no, it's totally closed. You can't get in there. And then she ended up getting in. And then when she walked into the studio, George and Ringo ended up looking up at her, giving her a smile. And then Paul gave her this little look as in like, you made it.
Aww.
Yeah. And so Yoko was there as well. And I don't think any other girlfriends were there at the time. Although I wrote that Paul was with Francie.
Okay.
I don't know who that is.
I can't recall who that is either.
Okay. Well, I guess it didn't last long anyways. So she was in the studio that day. And they needed more people to go up and clap. So that was the first time she was on a Beatles. And not the last time, but it was the first time that she was on a Beatles song. She said she was so busy that day that she didn't even ask what song it was. But she thinks that it was Revolution 9.
It all sounds so magical, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just show up and hear the Beatles are like making their music. And then, hey, why don't you come in and clap for us?
Totally.
It's like a dream.
Totally. And Yoko was clapping too. And then she said at the end, John just scrumpled up a piece of paper in front of the microphone. And she's like, oh, so that's how they did a bunch of little weird sounds.
John liked building up those strange sounds.
Yeah. So she was making herself useful and she had a do anything kind of attitude. She didn't care what people needed. She would just be happy to do it. She ended up getting them delicious lunches. And so she really prided herself on thinking, what could they want? Like, what would, like, they tell me that they want this thing and then I do it. But then how can I over?
Basically like a personal assistant to everyone at
to
Apple.
Everyone.
Yeah.
So then she actually became Peter Asher's assistant. Mm-hmm. So she was moving up a little bit. And it was in July of 1968 that she did backup vocals on Hey Jude.
Man.
Yeah. So there's a really nice moment where she talks about what what Paul was doing at that time. And so everybody was doing the background and they all were all clapping and swaying. She says, our separate voices soon blending into one resounding chorus. My fears disappeared, because she was worried about getting in and singing, of course.
Of course.
With my eyes focused on Paul, the skilled conductor leading the troops, his hands swooping in circles, the look of joy on his face mirrored on the faces of all the rest of us, I sang my heart out.
Her whole life is like magical moments. Jesus.
Yeah, it really is. So on January 30th, 1969, it was the final Beatles concert up on the roof of Apple.
Yes.
And it was essential staff only up there because the roof was too weak to support everyone. But as it goes, when you know the right people or if you're just talking to the right person at the right time, and that's a lot of what she said it was mm-hmm. like a lot of luck, a lot of right place, right time. And that's what a lot of people say, too. And,
absolutely, you know, yeah.
When I read that article the other day about like our neighborhood that we're in right now being the biggest hub of musicians in all of Canada in one area.
Yeah.
It's what it made me think of that too. It's just right place,
timing,
right time.
Is everything.
Yeah.
And luck. And Chris certainly had both of those on her side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then just who she was.
Yeah. And it didn't hurt that she was this adorable little blonde. The beautiful smile.
Yeah.
Very friendly.
But I don't think that her beauty and I don't think that it, like, her looks were intimidating.
Oh,
you
no.
know?
Yeah, like, friendly.
So yeah. welcoming, but she wasn't like she wasn't a model.
She wasn't a
no. you know.
She was approachable.
Yeah. So she ended up getting onto that roof because Tony Richmond, the head cameraman, brought her up as his assistant.
Nice.
Yeah. So Maureen was there. So Maureen is Ringo's wife.
Yep.
And she also tells the account of, well, before I say anything about Maureen, up on the roof, she said she was sitting beside Yoko as well. So she got to watch it, and she got to look down at the people who were looking up at, like, to figure out what that music was. So, yeah, at the beginning when she met Maureen, things weren't...
They had an interesting friendship.
Absolutely. So, but you can't blame Maureen because people had actually tried to gouge out Maureen's eyes.
Oh, like, yeah.
People tried to scratch her and they hurt her.
They were crazy back then.
Yeah, because of the relationship with the Beatles. And Maureen and Ringo met when they were 16. And the account of, like, their separation and the end of their marriage in this book is really sad.
Oh, God, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So she talks about Denny Cordell. Mm-hmm. Denny Cordell being around a lot. And the first time I ever heard about Denny Cordell was when I was watching Tom Petty's Running Down a Dream.
Of course.
And he said something about, you know, the Heartbreakers. Oh, he's smoking that fucking reefer. So at the time, Denny was Joe Cocker's manager and producer.
Nice.
And so Denny was really respected really young, like the ages of 21 and 24. He was already on fire. People really respected him. And so Joe Cocker was about to sing and record Paul's song Bathroom Window.
She came in through the bathroom window.
Yeah. So he was pretty grumpy. And when he came in before to record, he asked anybody for a smoke. And Chris, you know, nobody had anything, but Chris always kept a little bit of hash in her bag just in case. And she was like, well, I've got a hash joint. And then all of a sudden, Joe Cocker noticed that she was in the room and was like, went and sat beside her.
My new best friend.
Yeah, like, bless you. And then so all of a sudden, everybody, you know, smoked the hash joint. The attitude, the feeling, the atmosphere of the room changed. Everybody was happier. That's it. Yeah. So that's kind of another funny little story that she's got there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I like that cover of a bathroom window. It's a good one.
Yeah.
He really nailed all his Beatle covers. A little help from my friends. Yeah. Anytime I think of that song, I think of Joe's version instead of the Beatles.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So another big thing happened shortly after this, and it was at the Isle of Wight. Mm-hmm. So she was dating a guy at the time, and she was going to backpack and train there. They were just going to sleep in a tent, you know, like all of the other, like normal folk, as she called them. So her and her boyfriend were just discussing, you know, the normal folk accommodations when they get a phone call. And they got a phone call saying that Bob Dylan forgot all of his harmonicas. And that they needed to go buy more. So they gave them, like, the list of which harmonicas they needed to go buy, I guess, in which key. And then they were to send them in a helicopter over. And she's like, okay, so I'll just send the helicopter over and then we'll take our train. And they were like, no, no, no. You bring the harmonicas in the helicopter to the farmhouse where Bob Dylan was staying. So she's like, all right.
That's an important mission.
Yeah. So George Harrison and Patty Boyd were there. And as they came down in the helicopter, Patty and George came to greet them. And Bob Dylan was sticking his head out of the second story window, just watching them come down. She had met Patty twice before this, but it's now around this time where her and Patty really started to, like, become friends.
Build a friendship.
So she had met Patty once and just said something like, I love your makeup. I hope that you can teach me to do my makeup sometime. Aww. And Patty just kind of gave her, like, oh, yeah, whatever, yeah, or something. And, like, one other time. Oh, it was when George Harrison was in the hospital and she just kind of ran into her briefly. And
it must have been strange, too, for, like, these women. I mean, to have another young, beautiful woman come in who...
Okay, well, that was a whole thing. And, like, this is a whole thing that I also have written out, is that when things get a little bit complicated with, like, interband relationships and wife swapping and things, a lot of the times they went back to, like, well, you know what? Better you than somebody that we don't know.
Yeah.
It happened a lot where they went, like, it went both ways with the women and the men going, well, we're just happy that at least she's a part of the group.
Keep it in the family.
Because we don't want any outsiders getting in on this, like, family business anyways.
Yeah.
But... you know, Patty had said she had never met a woman, regardless of how close their friendship was, that didn't try to make a move on George.
Yeah.
Not a single one. except for Chris. So Chris, and so Patty told her this right away. And so that's why Patty said, well, that's why I prefer the being with my sisters. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough.
Yeah.
Her sister was with Eric Clapton before she was.
Yep.
But anyways, Chris had kind of made an agreement or like an oath to both herself and Patty that George would never get in between their friendship. And she held on to that forever. Not that George didn't try.
Oh, yeah.
He tried, but Chris wouldn't do it.
That's a good friend.
Yeah, so they started getting close, you know, George and Moll, who is George's bodyguard. Patty and Chris all played tennis together during that festival. And then she gives a really awesome description of seeing Bob Dylan walk down the stairs with his girlfriend, Sarah.
And Bob got his harmonicas.
Falling behind. And Bob certainly got his harmonicas.
And he married Sarah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so she was just talking a lot about what kind of magical woman Sarah was and how she just floated down the stairs with, Sarah. Walking down the stairway with his wife, Sarah. Oh, they were married at the time. He looked as though he'd just rolled out of bed with his hair tousled, his shirt untucked, and his face unshaven. Oddly enough, he seemed perfectly matched with Sarah, who was elegant and soft-featured, dressed in flowing clothes that gave her the look, as she floated down the stairs, of an angel descending from the heavens. He was the hoodlum to her choir girl, the knave to her queen, the beast to her beauty.
Aww.
And yet, when Sarah stood close to me, I felt the intensity of her gaze and the keen intelligence that directed it.
Sarah was sort of a socialite. She came from a really wealthy family, and it's been said that this was around the time that Edie Sedgwick apparently had a thing for Bob Dylan, and she was really heartbroken when she read the newspaper to discover that he had married Sarah.
Mm.
Especially since they both came from that same background, you know, very well-to-do families, socialites, and yeah, it really broke her heart. But Sarah was really beautiful. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that.
It's a lovely description of her.
Extra bit of rock and roll a little history addition. Trivia links.
You're welcome.
Okay, so that night, George, Patty, John, Yoko, Ringo, Maureen, and Chris sat in front of the stage on their little folding chairs in like a private little area, and they watched Bob Dylan from kind of the front of the stage.
Magic.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Bob?
No.
Well, I know he's like, nowadays people say it's like a 50-50 chance if it's going to be a good performance or a mumbling mess. But I got to see him a couple years ago, and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could make out every word.
Are they going to say make out? I could make out with him any day. Yeah, that's coming later in this episode, by the way, guys. So you stick with us. We're getting there. So she was figuring out, okay, like, I'm going to take the train back now. And John was like, why would you take the train back? There just happens to be one spot on our jet going home for you. So she flew back on their private plane with all of them. And they almost crashed. Like, the plane almost crashed. Apparently, they went through, God, like, a crazy round of... And she said they were just chanting. They just chanted the entire time and
got through it.
They got through it. Yeah. So she ended up meeting both Leon Russell and Eric Clapton around this time. And she ended up having a relationship, an intimate relationship with Leon Russell. And she at first really liked Eric Clapton, and she wanted to maybe have a relationship with him. And then they ended up despising each other.
Oh, yeah.
As the years went on.
Oh, yeah. Eric is a difficult man to be around.
Oh, yeah.
Or
yeah.
Was, I should say.
Yeah. So
Leon.
Yeah, but Leon. Leon, not a great guy either. He kind of, like, straight from the beginning was like, no matter what happens. And she's like, what are you talking about? Why are we starting a relationship going like, no matter what happens? And he would always, like, allude to, like, if we ever, like, cheat on each other. And she's just like, what?
Why are you saying
Come on. Anyways.
That's, like, a red flag right there.
Yeah, but she kind of wasn't going after him at first. She wasn't really interested. He was pursuing her, and the, you know, age old thing happened was he wrote a song about her, and then she, when he was in the studio and he was singing a song about the Pisces apple lady, she's a Pisces, she knew that he was really into it. She really, like,
speaking of, I'm pretty sure if you go on YouTube you can find Leon talking about this.
Oh, nice.
And Chris, yeah,
I think so. Yes, actually, I have it up right here.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I do, because I was looking at videos of her this morning, so we'll post some of those. It's funny, Danny Cordell is the one that introduced them, and when the song came on, he gave her kind of a knowing look. Mm. Yeah. So at this point, Chris was like hooking up these musicians together too to like play on each other's albums. So she was like, oh, hey, Leon, you should, you know, Paul was looking for somebody to play piano on something. And they ended up like,
they just go in and out of the studios together. And
yeah. So she started dating Leon Russell, and then she moved to LA with him, where she was miserable.
Yeah.
Miserable. She left what she was doing at Apple Music to go live with him. And so from November of 1969 to March 1970, all of a sudden she was like somebody's old lady.
Yeah.
And that was it.
It's interesting how so many of these women in that era, because a lot of the time women sort of are conditioned, like growing up, find the man, be the wife, you know, this is the way, this is the path you're supposed to follow. And then of course when they do follow that, they realize, wait a minute, like, I have so much more to give than just this. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
And she loved keeping busy, she loved being of service, she loved helping out. And now all of a sudden she's just at home doing painting by numbers.
Yeah,
actually doing painting by numbers. And Leon was off doing creative things.
Yeah.
Right? But she couldn't stand just going and sitting and watching him in the studio, because if you're not helping or doing anything, then, like, what are you...
Feeling useless is not a nice feeling.
Yeah. So they ended up... Leon ended up cheating on her.
Shocker.
Yeah. And she ended up moving in with a woman named Eileen, who is Denny's secretary at Shelter Records. Basically, yeah... Like, she kind of went from place to place, too. So, living with certain people. And a lot of the times, like, she would just crash with people. So, it seems like she didn't really pay rent between the years of 1969 and 1980.
I got that impression from the book as well. I think I sort of mentioned that to you when we were kind of talking about her. And
yeah.
That was a weird... I was like, do I remember this correctly? Like...
Yeah, but she did a lot of stuff for a lot of people, and I kind of like that she was just like, yeah.
Yeah.
She let people help her, too, in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I liked that.
It was a give and take, for sure. I mean, she definitely earned her place in that world. She worked hard.
Yep. She ended up going back to London, because that was her, like, that's where her heart
was.
That's
her world, yeah.
That's her world, that she did not want to be in LA anymore. So she flew back to London, and if she wasn't already working for Neil Aspinall as his assistant, she was now. Sorry if I got the little detail messed up. She also went to work for George at Friar Park. So she's being paid by Apple, but she's also now, like, George's
personal
assistant. Everything.
Yeah.
She remembers driving up to Friar Park at 2 a.m. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for anyone who hasn't seen Friar Park, Google it right now.
Oh, my goodness.
Unbelievable. And read Patty's book. The way she describes it is just magical.
Yeah. It's true. Magical, but it's also like haunted as fuck. Yeah. So they were all freaked out all the time. They didn't use
like half of the
more than half of the rooms. They all slept very in near the living room as possible because that's where the fire was and that's where the heat was. And so she talks about pulling up to Friar Park for the first time at 2 a.m. And she thought that like the guest house was Friar Park. And she was like, oh, it's beautiful, George. And he's like, just wait. So she says that she remembers Patty being gracious and friendly and just like she was all cozy and her like, you know, high socks and hair all tousled. And but she later learned that Patty was miffed at George because he just invited a woman to come live at their home, you know,
without asking
consulting. Although they are friends at this point.
Yeah. That's still,
she's still kind of thinking, what are his intentions and what are his motives? Because as I said before,
he had cheated in the past.
It was hard for her for Patty to trust anybody.
Yeah.
So a guy named Terry lived there too, who
lots of people live there in and out.
But it was pretty much like the four of them at this time that were there, and she really felt like she was part of the family. Jenny Boyd was married to Mick Fleetwood at this time, so Patty would catch her up on what Jenny was doing in the world and, you know, Fleetwood Mac. But George's moods changed a lot. So he would bounce back and forth very often between, like, the fun, you know, druggy, don't really care attitude of, you know, of that kind of George Harrison to the really spiritual George Harrison. And so when he got really spiritual and did his, like, you know, he would go on and on about things, Patty and Terry would just go, oh, okay, well, it's time for us to go to bed. And Chris would just stay up and listen to him talk about things. So it's at this point where, you know, George was talking about Nirvana. There's no place like Nirvana. And Chris would say, what is Nirvana? Truly interested in the answer. And so this is what George had to say about that. Or this is what Chris says that
George said.
Nirvana is the release of the soul from the endless cycle of rebirth. The final destination. A look of peace spread across his face. I sat there contentedly, wide-eyed, attempting to take in every word he was saying, finding comfort in his soothing voice, being consoled by the idea that there was a great plan for all of us, and that a god of some sort was watching over us. Every so often, I nodded my head or muttered a soft, wow, or really? You have to deal with the karma of your past lives, Chris. That's the purpose for being here, he said. Say the Hare Krishna chant over and over, and you will feel closer to God.
George must have been so happy to have someone listen and not just, you know, roll their eyes.
Totally. And I think, you know, Patty did go to India with him, and she did try to get into it. But really, the more spiritual George got, the more he detached to everybody, everything, including Patty.
Yeah, their relationship definitely suffered because of his dedication to the Hare Krishna movement.
Yeah, yeah. So this is just shortly before the Krishnas moved in. Mm-hmm. They ended up going to a party, and Chris was at this party sitting by the fire where Ringo engaged her in conversation. And that's where their friendship and relationship kind of started. But Maureen walked straight up to them and pretty much demanded that they leave right away.
Maureen could tell.
She knew that something was going to happen, and something eventually did happen.
Yeah.
Which we'll get there. It was beyond Chris that a Beatles wife would see her as a threat. It really was. So it was around this time now that the Krishnas did start moving in, and you can imagine what that might have
been
like.
Poor Patty.
Ooh, your whole house is taken over by a bunch of people and children, and
no one really watching the children. I remember her talking about that in her book.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine.
She said George walked around all day with his hand in his prayer bag, quietly repeating the words, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Friends didn't stop by as much, except for the occasional visits from Eric Clapton, who enjoyed sitting with Patty and me in the kitchen.
I wonder why he was there.
She was completely oblivious to that, apparently, at the time. And George spent the other time just in the garden.
They were all oblivious to the audience.
But that's when But yeah, okay, so that's, and so Eric was stopping by, but it would be years before he and Patty got together. Yeah. But that's where it started. So now we're into April and May of 1970. Paul quits the band. Mm-hmm. And they're all really shocked because every time anybody tried to quit the Beatles, Paul would, like, get them back together. So that's when George started working on All Things Must Pass. Mm-hmm. And I love that record.
Oh, God, me too.
I love, love, love that record. And so what Chris did was she would sit in the kitchen with George and she'd have her typewriter and she typed up all of the lyrics to that album. So he'd come to her with, like, backs of envelopes, like with lyrics on backs of envelopes and Apple stationery. And then she'd type it up and then she'd give it to him and then he changed a few things back and forth and then she'd give it back and then she would perfect them for him. So she said that at this point, the garden at Fire Park was in full bloom and Patty just cooked with the beautiful herbs and she was just always making the meals and just always trying to make Fire Park a home, make it more beautiful, make it more welcoming. But she was feeling left out, and Chris didn't know this at the time, but Patty was feeling left out between the relationship between George and Chris. Mm-hmm. And George started getting kind of cranky again at this point, where he started getting jealous of Chris and Patty's relationship. So, you know, Patty went to Los Angeles to go buy some things for Fire Park, and Patty wanted Chris to go with her, and George didn't want Chris to go. So then Patty said, well, I'll leave my car here for you, Chris, and you take it whenever you want. So Chris took the car out, because then she was left alone at Fire Park with nothing to do, and then George got mad at her for taking the car out. So things were starting to get a little bit tense at Fire Park, so she ended up moving to London with a woman named Diane who worked for John Lennon.
Okay.
Now, she answered the phone one day, and she said, hello, and it was like a, hello, who is this? She was like, this is Chris O'Dell, and she was like, who is this? And she was like, oh, and then she got like a, oh, it was Yoko on the phone. Yoko Ono called, and Yoko was pissed because Chris was living with Diane, who worked for John, and Yoko didn't like that because she said Chris was a part of George's camp.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So then she moved again, she went to go live with Eric Clapton.
Oh, God.
Who she still had a crush on at this point, was still oblivious to the affair that he was having with Patty. And she moved into Hurtwood Edge. And so she was like, okay, well, I'll help them with the house and I'll do this here and there. The Dominoes were living there. And she said it was just like a mess. But she'd cook and then she would, like, once she started living there, she would listen to Eric go on and on about how torturous it was that he wasn't able to be with Patty. She talks about this one time where he started smashing all of these plates and, yeah.
He really put, like, all of his happiness on her, didn't he?
Yeah, and then when he got her, what did he do? Oh, he's such an asshole.
Yep.
Okay, so she was living with them at this time, and they were doing a lot of drugs. So they were mixing drinking with cocaine, with Mandrax, which was an upper, and then Quaaludes, which was a downer. So she was being, I think she went in and out of Apple Music or of Apple for Apple Music. I'm so used to saying that, from Apple Records, like on and off. And there was at this point where she got a call from George that warned her that, like, there wasn't a spot for her there right now.
Okay.
So then she was out of a job. So then she went back to LA to work for Peter Asher, where she lived with him and his wife. So she's always running around from one thing to the next, but she never had, like, trouble getting a job, yeah, right? So then this is what she said were her duties. I settled right into the work routine, putting in long hours for Peter, just as I had when I worked for him at Apple. I helped organize his office, located in the guest house, answered the phones, typed the correspondence, made appointments, booked studios, organized itineraries, took care of the musicians he represented, arranging transportation, helping them with personal problems, and generally watching over them, letting them know I was right there if any problems arose.
That was her job. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So, around this time, so do we need to do a year check-in for everybody? Like, what year? It's 1971 at this point. And George comes to Malibu at this time. So, she got her distance from George and Patty and everybody. And George comes to Malibu and he kept inviting her over. And he said, like, please come over. Kept calling her. And she wouldn't. Like, she was just feeling weird about everything that happened. And, yeah, you know,
they're far from how, home. And
yeah. And how his attitude had changed. But finally, she goes to visit him. And this is where she learns that George Harrison had written a song about her. Yes. And for her. It was about, and all, but it was like, I think it was mostly like for her. So he says,
yes, Miss Odell.
Yeah, it's called Miss Odell. Won't you call me Miss Odell? So he says, I have something for you, he said. He jumped up from the couch and headed for the bedroom. I felt my heart beat faster. Uh-oh, I thought. What if he comes back and with a negligee and has me try it on? You just never knew with George. He returned half a minute later with his acoustic guitar and sat down next to me on the couch. Pushing his hair back behind both ears, holding the pick in his right hand between his forefinger and thumb, he looked at me, his head tilted, and said, I'm going to make you famous. Aww. I had no idea what to expect. He began singing, looking straight at me. It was such a fun song, so light and folksy. It really is. It's really, really cute. I've been listening to it all morning. And she, one of her first reactions to it was not only did she love it, but she was worried about what Patty was going to think.
Yeah.
Like, what could Patty think that something had happened to, with the relationship? But he ended up playing it for Patty, and Patty loved it. She liked it. Mm-hmm. So at this point, All Things Must Pass was a huge success, and everybody just kind of chilling in L.A., just like enjoying everything that happened. And so Patty came down to L.A. too, and now they're all just like hanging out in L.A., and things with the relationships were mended, and everything's fine. I think they just all kind of needed a little bit of time away from each other. So she was making a lot of food and cooking with Patty at this point, and then that's when the concert for Bangladesh, the idea for that came, and Ravi was talking to George about it, and so George got really excited. George really wanted to do something now that All Things Must Pass was a huge success, so he got everybody that he wanted together to come and play this festival. At this time, Eric Clapton was huge into heroin.
Yep.
He was definitely invited, but he was into heroin because of the threat that he had made to Patty, if you don't be with me, I'm going to go and do heroin.
What a terrible thing to do to someone. She's a married woman, and he's throwing, like, his life or death on her, basically. If you don't leave George and be with me, I'm going to become a heroin addict.
Yeah, so that's what he did. But George invited him anyways, and he also invited Bob Dylan. So those were the other two really big names at this festival, which took place on August 1st at Madison Square Gardens. So Chris hung out with Patty in their suite looking over Central Park, and they just like went shopping, had fun, watched TV, and George was really edgy and distracted because he was really focusing on last minute details. And then he was worried that Eric Clapton and Bob Dylan wouldn't show up because at the last minute John Lennon didn't show up because he had some fight with Yoko. So Eric Clapton was on his way, but everybody was worried because he was in really bad shape, and they actually had to find him heroin so that he could be functional.
Yeah.
And if Bob Dylan didn't show up, well, like, that would just be a snub.
Mm-hmm.
So, he ended up showing up.
Yes.
Bob Dylan ended up, like, showing up, and Eric Clapton did a great job, and he got it together, and it was a really great festival. So, 1971, she gets another call. Because at this point, she's not really working for, like, her work was suffering. She wasn't.
Yeah, she's trying to figure out what's
the
next
move.
Yeah.
Well, she got a call. And she got a call from a man named Leonard who ran Rolling Stones Records. So he needed an assistant. And so if he needs an assistant, it's pretty much like the Rolling Stones need an assistant. And that's what she became.
Oh, yes. Enter Mick.
Oh, yeah. I really like her relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what she did is, like, she found homes for Mick to be, like, to stay at in L.A. with Bianca, and for Keith to stay in with Anita, and a place for Mick Taylor and his wife Rose. So this is what he said. You'll need to find nice houses for them to rent, take care of daily business, book the recording sessions, attend to their personal needs, and then there's the album to worry about. Getting the cover designed, lining up the photographers, the whole fucking thing. Charlie and Bill will be in town now and then too, and they'll need hotel rooms, limos, cash, dry cleaning, that kind of stuff. I'm hiring you as my personal assistant, so you'll also be helping with the contracts, secretarial work, phone calls, and all of the rest of it. Can you handle that? Marshall leaned over in his chair and actually took a breath. I can handle it, I said.
Great.
Yeah. So, yeah.
She could handle it.
Yeah, she did. She definitely could. So this was the album that they're talking about is for Exile on Main Street. And she's actually on the back cover of that album. A picture of her.
I love that album so much.
Can you picture what I'm... I should have had it out here.
I can't, actually.
So another thing that she did... was she worked on the song lyrics for Exile on Main Street. So she would listen to like what Mick was like. She would listen to it and then she actually wrote it the lyrics that way. And then she'd have him check them and kind of went on like that. And so one thing that she said that was interesting when she was finding all of these houses, like these perfect houses for them to live in during that time, it reminded her that they didn't even have security really or gates or anything. Yep. And she said that Leon had said to her once, someday we'll all live in gated houses. And at the time, she thought he was just being pessimistic, but really it ended up being true.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she said that she didn't like stopping in to see Anita and Keith very often because it was dark and depressing.
They were deep into their heroin.
Yeah. And it's so funny because people can go and like listen to the episode on Patty Boyd and George Harrison, or they can go back and listen to the like the one that you did on Anita Pallenberg. And like, yeah, so these stories they are really intersecting. It's amazing. Yep. So she said that she didn't take Anita's bad manners or drugged out personality personally because she felt absolutely no connection to her. Mm-hmm. She said she was a man's woman, not a woman's woman like Patty. And we pretty much just ignored each other.
Yeah.
So she liked Keith a lot. And unlike Mick, he didn't need a lot. So she'd do Keith spanking. She'd run little errands for him. And he'd always want her to hang out afterwards. But she was always really reluctant to do that. She didn't want to like stay around and hang out with them because she said it was just it dark.
It was bad seeing them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She helped out with Mick Jagger's personal life, responding to party invitations for him, booking Bianca's hair and nail appointments. But she thought it was fun. She liked doing those things because at nighttime she'd go to recording sessions and if there wasn't anything to do during the day, she'd just hang out by the pool.
Mm-hmm.
She went to a Chuck Berry concert with Mick and Keith once.
Awesome.
Yeah. And there was one time where she was sitting around with Keith and Mick and she had given them the newest issue of Rolling Stone magazine. And Keith was reading about the Bangladesh concert, just like talking shit about George Harrison. And she said, you know, George is my friend. And they kind of went, oh, yeah, you're a Beatles girl. And that's what she said. Like I was. I loved the Rolling Stones, but I was a Beatles girl like through and through. And, you know, she went on tour with the Stones. She became good friends with Astrid, who was with Bill. She went with them to the Playboy Mansion. She traveled on their jet. And she said that she hardly spent any time in her seat because she was always up talking to somebody or other. Keith did end up sending on her on errands to get his drugs.
Oh, yeah.
And she said it never occurred to her to say no. And then she said, somewhere around Dallas, I started sleeping with Mick.
Yep.
Yeah. So she said it was no big deal. Like, it wasn't a big thing. It was a simple relationship. Mick liked to spend time with me. I loved the attention, and sleeping with him strengthened the trust between us. I bet that most of the women who worked for Mick had slept with him. If there had been a job description for being employed by the Stones back then, I'm pretty sure it would have included a proviso that went something like this. Sleep with Mick whenever he asks. Oh. So she didn't have any romantic fantasies about the future with him. Kind of like Pamela DeBar when she was with him.
Yeah.
They enjoyed it. It was fun. But they were like, we are not. Like, he's
they
not.
Both knew it was up. Like, this wasn't a romantic relationship. It was just a fun fling.
Yeah. She said, I didn't have any romantic fantasies about the future. And I never once, not ever thought, boy, I should like to be Mick's girlfriend. Nope. Being Mick's girlfriend would have been too much work. He was just too unpredictable, too unfaithful, too, well, just too much.
Yeah.
I hear that. Man, this is going to be one of the longest episodes. Because I, like, how can we, like, leave these things out?
I know, they're so good.
We're going to keep going. So now we're in 1973. Ringo and Harry Nilsson are shooting the Son of Dracula movie. Mm-hmm. And so she showed, like, she was invited to go see them on set, which she did. She was drinking scotch and snorting coke with them and Patty, visiting the set. And she said at this point, drugs were really starting to affect her emotional and mental state.
Starting to get too much.
Yeah. The Stones tour was over. She didn't have a job. She was just getting messed up and hanging around at the Chateau Marmont all the time. She was spending more time alone in her apartment, doing drugs. But that's when her relationship with Maureen really started to get to take off, because Maureen was kind of depressed and dark at this time, too. So they'd spend every day together. They would spend the entire day together. They'd start drinking and, like, smoking pretty early on during the day. And then Ringo would come back from the studio and they would hang out for the rest of the night together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maureen talks about her early relationship with Ringo. She'd always be stirring things up for Chris, but, like, in a nice way. Like, she would always organize and surprise things for Chris. Like, for example, Chris mentioned that she really wanted to go see David Bowie. Mm-hmm. And Maureen was like, I don't know why you'd want to do that. And then the next day she got her, like, tickets.
Yeah.
And then she even set up, like, an afterword, like, everyone going out for dinner together after the show. David Bowie, Angie, Mick, Ronson, Ringo, Maureen, they were all having...
It's interesting that they were so close, considering what's going to happen later.
Yep. So Chris was saying that she had met Angie before because her and Patty had interviewed Angie for a book about women behind the scenes in rock and roll.
What? Where's this book?
Yeah. So I'll show you the page. It's on page 251 that they talked about it. And it's like, where is this book? Did this book ever end up? Like, we need to talk to Chris about this.
Yes.
So I just wrote rock and roll, like, the scenes in the rock and roll world, and then I just wrote WTF question mark. Where did that go?
Yeah.
So now it's the end of 1973, Christmas in England. Maureen invited her to spend Christmas with her, but she usually spent it with Patty and George. So what she did this time was decided to spend Christmas with Maureen and Ringo and then New Year's with Patty and George. And this hurt Patty. And this hurt Patty for a few different reasons. Now, what Chris didn't know at this time was that Maureen was engaged in a relationship with George Harrison.
Yep.
So we're talking, we've already alluded to the fact that Chris O'Dell gets with Ringo, mm-hmm. but that wasn't before Maureen started spending a lot of time at Friar Park, and she would even start sleeping over there.
Just right in front of everyone.
Yeah, she would stay over.
Yeah.
And so there was a point where Chris was upstairs with Patty in her room going, Patty, what is going on? And then there was another famous moment where it was George, Ringo, Patty, Maureen,
and Chris.
And
George says,
George looks over at Ringo and says, you know, Ringo, I'm in love with your wife.
And Ringo said, better you than someone we don't know.
Exactly. Which happens... to George,
yeah.
What, a few years later, yep. when Eric goes, I gotta tell you, man, yep. I'm in love with your wife. And it was kind of the same thing. So that's when we're talking about, like, they almost just preferred to keep it in the family.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that it wasn't hurtful. It doesn't mean that, like, people were pissed. And there was a point where Patty said to Chris, oh, that George is such a monster. Aww. And, like, and then on the other hand, she had George, like, kind of whispering in her ear, like, it's not easy being George Harrison.
Oh, poor you. Poor George.
You know, George saying, like, Chris, you're the lucky one.
Oh, God.
So, Maureen said that her relationship with George Harrison was emotional, not physical. And then this is when Chris started hanging out more and more with Ringo. Oh, one more thing about keeping it in the family. At this point, John was dating a woman named May.
Yep.
Who Yoko encouraged because she saw that John was starting to pull away. And then again, it was the same thing that she mm-hmm. was like, well, you at least
I know. And at least
I know you.
Yeah. You're with me. Get this out of your system, basically.
Yeah.
That lasted, what, like a year and a half or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
So one night, Chris finds herself with Ringo in the studio, and things start to happen. Like, emotionally, they start kind of seeing each other in a different light. And they had a dance. Like, they danced together, and they were face-to-face. She said she really looked at him in a different way this time. Then there was one night where they went to Roman Polanski's for a party, which ended up being really weird, they said, in Santa Monica, and they spent like the whole night and morning together and like just talking. And then they pretty much spent the next few weeks with him in a beach house in Santa Monica. She ended up calling him Rich, because Maureen called him Richie. But Maureen and Ringo were still together. They're still married. And Ringo asked Chris not to tell Maureen. But then there was a point where Maureen just like walked, like she didn't walk in on them, but she knew that they were spending time together. And Maureen just like poured everybody a drink. They all sat down and Maureen was like, "Chris, are you sleeping with my husband?" And then Chris had this thing, this loyalty thing. "Well, Ringo asked me not to say anything, but Maureen is my best friend, one of my best friends right now. So she said, yes, we're sleeping together." Ringo was pissed for a really, like, for a while. But they all ended up staying friends.
Yeah. And they were all cheating on each other.
Yeah. So, 1974, she becomes the tour manager for Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. So she said her, as a tour manager, she was the babysitter, mother, secretary, therapist, problem solver, travel agent, maid, and alarm clock.
Bet you that one was a difficult. We all know what they think of each other.
She said it was madness. She said it was a dysfunctional gathering of egos.
Yeah.
David ranted, Stephen pouted, Graham mediated, and Neil stayed as far away as possible.
Oh, man.
All right. So, I'm on my last page of notes here. We're wrapping up, but we're not losing momentum. So it was on this tour that she met Cameron Crowe. And he said, "Do you know you're one of the only female tour managers out there?" Pretty cool, huh? That's what he said to her. She said that he was uncomplicated, unpretentious, and undemanding. So it was around this time that Patty left George for Eric. And
if you don't know that story,
it's the first episode of this entire podcast. And
that's quite a story.
The first time that she ever saw, that Chris ever saw Eric Clapton's name was spray painted somewhere in London. And yeah. It said, "Clapton is God." And she said he was by this point. And especially because how he treated Patty, the mm-hmm. whole wedding being a bet, and how he just totally used her and then almost like threw her away after they were married. She said, "He was no god to me. He was a royal pain in the ass."
It should be noted that Eric Clapton's the one who spray painted that all over London.
What?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Oh. Okay. So, yeah, she was a bridesmaid at their wedding, but she wouldn't even stand up there with them because of like how Eric might have just like made a comment or something.
Yeah, he was a miserable man at that point in life.
Yeah.
Have you ever noticed how he looks so different in every photo of him? I know it's him, but I feel like if you didn't know that 60s Eric Clapton is like 1975 Eric Clapton, like, they look so different.
Yeah.
Like, they're hardly the same person.
Yep.
And I guess they weren't really. Like, the 70s were not good for him.
No. So, 1975 to 1976, she becomes a tour manager for Bob Dylan on his Rolling Thunder tour.
Ah, Bob.
What even? So, she had another. So, it was another incident where she's dancing mm-hmm. with one of these guys that like something starts to happen. So it was an after party at a Howard Johnson, and she finds herself with Bob Dylan alone, the last two people there dancing. And so they're dancing and he's telling her that she smells so good. And she couldn't exactly say it back because he had been playing all night. So he didn't smell bad, but he didn't smell great is what she ended up saying. And he kind of like said something like about being attracted to her and that like he could tell that she felt the same way.
He was like, seducing her.
He was seducing her, but she was kind of like, she kind of was like, I guess I'd better go. Oh, and he said this, I know that you know I'm making a pass at you, and you know that I know you're interested. And then he gave me a little kiss, not quite on the lips, and we said goodnight.
Aww.
Yeah. But don't worry, guys. You're like, oh, no, she blew it. Mm-mm. Nope. It happened.
She redeemed herself.
It happened. So he invited her up to his room after a night. He said he disappeared for a moment and came back holding a picture of himself. He looked really young with his little boy face surrounded by beautiful curls. I'd guess the picture was taken when he was in his early 20s. Somebody gave this to me the other night, he said, handing the photograph to me with a perplexed look on his face. I took the photograph and studied it for a moment, then looked up at him. I wasn't sure what he wanted me to say. Did I ever really look like that, he said? Was I ever really that person? I found the whole thing kind of weird. I didn't know Bob well enough to understand what he was asking, but it seemed to me that he felt as if he were looking at someone else. I wondered if he wanted me to connect the Dylan in the present, the person I had come to know, with this young man in the photograph. Did he want to talk about the time that had passed? Did he want to be reassured that he really was the same person who was framed in that picture? I almost got the sense that he wanted to go back in time, back to the beginning, before he was so famous. Or maybe it was just Bob Dylan's way of making small talk. Well, you were a lot younger then, I said, hoping that would end the conversation. He put the picture on the night table next to the bed and sat down next to me. I'm tired, he said. Want to lie down? And it just kind of went from there.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, yeah. God. So, I mean, since then, she worked with Led Zeppelin, ELO. In 1986, she had a son. She'd gotten married. Ringo was the godfather. Yeah. And she just, got sober.
I think this episode's going to be released on Bob Dylan's birthday.
Oh, my God. Actually, I saw Michael DeBar just release something saying that it's going to be Bob Dylan's birthday
in
week.
In a couple days, yeah.
Oh, perfect. Yep. Oh, great. So, yeah, Chris O'Dell, she's a licensed professional counselor and licensed substance abuse counselor. She's living in Arizona.
Still helping people.
Yeah. And so she says that she has, like, you know, these degrees. But she also has all of these pictures of her with these bands, and she calls them her degrees of good luck, great friends, being in the right place at the right time. She says they are, in truth, my degrees of life.
Ah, oh, beautiful. Beautiful. Great way to end her tale as well.
Yeah.
What a life, my God.
Wow. Totally. And she's in Arizona, and
Helping people,
and Miss O'Dell.
We love you.
We love you. Thank you so much for this wonderful account. Thank you for being there. And hopefully we'll get to talk to you one of these days.
Yes. It's so great when these women share their stories. And we love spreading the word on them.
We sure do. Mm. Okay. Well, thank you for lending me this book, Lynx.
Absolutely.
Was a joy to read. I'm sad that it's over, but I really, really loved it. I really felt like you just felt like you were there.
I read it when it came out, so it's been a while. So thank you for reminding me of all the awesome little tidbits in there. This was fun.
Yeah, it really was. Okay, everybody, if you want more muses and stuff, then definitely go back and listen to some past episodes. You can find them on iTunes. Mm-hmm. You can also find them on our website at musesandstuff.ptbopodcasters.ca.
Yeah, and you can find us on Twitter at Shanti and Lynx. And you can find us on Instagram at Muses and Stuff Podcast.
That's right. Thank you for listening, everybody. And we'll be back with you next week and we'll tell you how Webfest went.
Yes.
Yeah. So take care. We love you. Bye for now.
dear stranger, I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.